Welcome to Her Leading Story, a podcast that will inspire you with stories from amazing female leaders and give you some ideas to help you design a life and a career that's perfect for you. It's totally doable, and the good news is that you'll have me and our community of leading women by your side every single step of the way. Let's get started. I'm your host, Julie Artis, and this is Her Leading Story. Well, welcome to Her Leading Story. I am so excited to welcome my guest this week, Dr. Adia Gooden. She is a clinical psychologist, a speaker, and a writer, and I am going to let her talk a little bit more about what she's doing these days. Maybe not what you would have expected for a clinical psychologist.
Thanks, Julie. It's so good to be here. So these days I'm running my own business. The main things I do is I coach high achieving professional women on embracing their unconditional self-worth. And I also do a lot of speaking, talking about self-worth and imposter syndrome. And I actually also have a forthcoming book that I co-authored on Black women's mental health. So it's sort of interesting to be out of the academic world, but then publishing this academic book. But that was a real fun project that I did in collaboration with my co-author and a number of other authors. And I have a podcast that you were just on. So those are kind of the main things that I'm spending my time on.
Great. So interestingly, Adia and I first met when she was a student earning her doctorate at DePaul University, and I was an outside reader from the sociology department on her committee. We had not been in touch for a little while, and then getting back in touch as we were both developing coaching businesses. I knew you from then, and I was on your podcast, and I know you a little bit now. But what I really like to do in this podcast is for you to take me back to college or high school and then trace your career choices and path. So maybe start with why psychology? Were you an undergrad psychology major? What about psychology really drew you in?
So I always come at this question from two angles. So on the one hand, I was always really interested in people. I was always curious about people. I liked helping people. I liked talking to people. I felt deeply connected to people's feelings and injustices and things like that. And so I went into college knowing that I was going to major in psychology. I didn't have plans to be a psychologist, but I knew I wanted to major in psychology. But then the other part of this story is that both of my parents are clinical psychologists. Oh. So they both have PhDs. And the crazy thing is they both have PhDs in clinical community psychology, which is also what I have my PhD in. So it's like, there's also that, right? Like,
yeah.
There's also this major modeling that happened. And, you know, my parents were never were like, you have to be a psychologist. Like, there was never any of that that happened. But when I was in college, you know, I majored in psychology and that was great. And then I did a number of different things for summer internships, like some working with kids, some working with homeless youth. One summer I worked with a philanthropic organization. So I was just kind of like trying to figure it out. And I had a really helpful conversation with my dad, who was kind of like, well, what do you like to do? His combination was like, figure out what you like to do and figure out a problem you want to solve and figure out the intersection of those two things. Mm-hmm. And when I was talking to him, he was kind of like, well, I think you should consider community psychology, like community or clinical psychology. And so he gave me a book. This is where like lots of privilege with my parents being in the field and being able to guide me. And it felt like a really good fit. Like it honestly felt like, yeah, this is, you know, I can work with people, I can do research, right? And I loved DePaul because of that, because the research was so applied and felt like it was actually helping people. So that's really where this path got started.
Wow. I didn't know that about your parents. That's fascinating. Now, did you grow up?
I came to Chicago for graduate school. I actually grew up in Southern California. People often look at me and they're like, what's wrong with you? Why would you make a life choice to move from Southern California to Chicago? That is a very common. People are like, I'm like, I didn't really know what I was getting into because I, you know, people say winter is bad, but from Southern California, I don't know what that means. Like, what does that mean? So yeah, I moved, but then I've stayed. So I now lived here for almost 16 years.
Wow. So you came to the city for the PhD program.
Yes.
And how was grad school? I'm just curious what it was like being in the PhD program in psychology. I've been on a bunch of those committees over the years, and I know a lot of the faculty there, but it's different work than I do, obviously. Mm-hmm. Totally different field.
Yeah. So there were some things that were great about it. The program is not competitive. It's very cohort based. So we had 6 people in our cohort and we would split up readings. Like you read this part, you read that part. It was very collaborative. We had a really good cohort and group. I feel like the faculty were very supportive. It was a good learning environment. Now, you know, my mental space, my mental environment was not so supportive, right? So when we started, I went straight from undergrad, right? So I was starting my program at 22. And for some reason, probably because I was trying to use it to prove my worth, I decided that I needed to graduate in 5 years. And so then I really, it's just like, why, girl? Why? So then I just like stress myself out, like, first you got to do the master's thesis and then you got to, you know, and at some point I was like, all right, like we got to go to therapy. We got to slow down. Like this is not necessary. Right. And so it was very much internally that pressure was put on me. Like we didn't have, I mean, I think if you got to like 7 years and you still hadn't gone on internship, and because clinical psych, you have to go on an internship, like then there probably would be some conversations about like, hey, like let's move it along. But it was very much an internal pressure.
So it was like self-imposed.
Yes, very much so self-imposed. And so, you know, I stressed myself out. But the thing I liked about it is that it really, there was a lot of opportunities to do different things, right? So, you know, we did research, and then because I was in the community program, we got to do field work. We had a field work class and went in and I did some consultation work with a community mental health center, and you were doing therapy, right? So there was a lot of sort of applied experiences that really related to what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So I would say overall, it was a good program. I got through it pretty much unscathed.
5 years?
No. No. It took me 6 years. So with the way clinical psych is set up, your last year is going to be your clinical internship where you go anywhere in the country, you match. It's kind of like a residency, but it's only 1 year. So, you know, it's like I had 5 years and then my sixth year was my internship, finishing up my dissertation, that sort of thing.
Okay. And where'd you do your internship?
I went back to Southern California and I was at the counseling center at the University of Southern California.
Okay. And so was that mainly focused on students or is it like a community facing thing or?
Yeah, it was students. In clinical psych, you do like externships for like your years when you're in grad school. So I had done 2 years at the University of Chicago in their counseling center. So I knew I really liked student counseling. And then I did my internship at USC. So it's still working with undergraduate and graduate students, doing therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and then also some outreach workshops and things like that, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah. Yeah. So then what brought you back to Chicago?
So 2 things. One, a boyfriend.
Yeah.
I'm not with that person anymore, but that. And I got a postdoctoral fellowship at the Family Institute at Northwestern. So I had done a little bit of couples therapy and was interested in it. And that was the focus. And that postdoc allowed for some sort of academic experiences. Like I taught, I think, while I was there, and also clinical work and training. So I came back and did a 2-year postdoc at the Family Institute and then have stayed since then.
Then, and I mean, because you're the first entrepreneur that I've interviewed. And of course, as somebody who's also an academic working on my own business, I'm just so curious to hear the story of how you had this postdoc. Did you stay at the Family Institute after the postdoc ended as well?
No. So the postdoc ended, I went back to the University of Chicago. Then I was there for 4 years in the counseling center. Then I went back to the Family Institute. And then I had administrative clinical position and I hated it. And then I left to start my own business.
Tell me more.
So like I loved college counseling and that was great, but I was starting to feel a little bit bored. I was starting to feel, you know, I want to do something more. And so I thought, okay, I applied to one fully academic position and then I think it was their second round pick. They told me the salary and I was like, oh no, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that.
Not happening. That is hilarious. So,
and it was not one of the prestigious, you know, like big prestigious institutions. Didn't have, but I was like, oh, like I, you know, I already had the feeling like this is just probably not going to be super aligned. But then they told me the salary and I was like, oh, no, thank you.
Yeah.
So then I took this job. It was a newly created position at the Family Institute and I thought it was going to be my dream job, right? I'm going to get a faculty appointment, right? And that's like the ultimate thing in academia.
Yeah.
And then I was going to help to oversee a community-based mental health outreach program and be over the person who was over the clinic. So there was a lot of things, and I was going to have my own clinical work. I was like, this is perfect, right? We've got the leadership, we got the faculty, we got all this stuff. So I got into the role and I was like, oh, I don't like this.
So what parts like though?
Okay. So the parts I didn't like, one is turns out I don't like people telling me what to do. And I didn't realize how much autonomy I had at the University of Chicago. I basically did what I wanted, partly because I got my work done. I saw more clients than almost anybody else in the center. And so if I wanted to do an outreach, I did an outreach. I didn't have a lot of, you need to do this and I don't agree. So that was one thing. A second thing was I really didn't feel fully seen or affirmed. Like I felt like I was doing a lot of work that was reduced and undervalued and potentially trotted out when it made them look good, but not really appreciated. And that did not like. And then I also just don't like being an administrator. Like operations and SOPs and what are we going to do about this? And students are complaining about that. And you got to send the email to the students 50 times because you sent it before, but they didn't like that stuff, like drives me bonkers. And that's kind of like, you know, I was overseeing, this wasn't the job originally, but it ended up that I was overseeing a clinic that had 100 trainees in it.
Oh.
Right. And like all these supervisors. So I was just like in the muck and I was like, I am not like, this is just not, it's great. Like there's some people who are like, this is their jam.
Yeah.
Not my jam. So it was just not the right space and place. And so it was not the right role. And I think in some ways I needed to have that experience, right? Like I needed to have the experience of getting a faculty appointment, having a leadership administrative role, doing what I thought was my dream job to let it go. Because it was so uncomfortable that it was very clear, this isn't for me. I'm not meant to do this. And so I could release that and move on to what I do now, which is so much more aligned.
Yeah. How long were you in that administrative appointment at the Family Institute?
Not that long. I started September 2019.
Okay.
And obviously like pandemic happens, right? And then I left, actually we're like at the 2 year anniversary basically. I left February 26th, 2021.
Wow. Okay.
So like a year and a half.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah. And a lot of it during remote work and pandemic time and all of that.
Right. So those were extra things. And I had to work through a lot of guilt around leaving. I initially was like, okay, I'm going to create a 5-year plan, partly because I was like, I need these student loans to be forgiven. Like, come on. And then I had a really good friend who was like, you need to think about the emotional cost of staying. Yeah. And I was like, oh, yeah. And so I had to work through a lot of guilt around leaving people that I cared about, around leaving programs that I thought were really important for the community. But I realized and I was able to see if I'm miserable, I'm not able to do a great job. And there's somebody out there that would love this work, that will be great at this role. And so me leaving actually opens the opportunity for them to step into the role. Mm-hmm. And shifting that really helped me to feel like, okay, I can do this. And then also every time I got upset, I was like, 5 years, 3 years, 2 years, 9 months, 6 months. I was like, I gotta get out. So, I mean, I gave him 4 months lead time. You know, I was like, you got 4 months and then I'm going, because I wanted it to be a healthy, good transition. But it was the best professional decision I've ever made.
Wow. It takes a lot of courage, too. I mean, did you look for other jobs, or what was your thought process about what to do next?
That's a good question. It was very clear to me that I didn't want to work anywhere else. I don't really know why it was so clear, but it was crystal clear. I think it was people telling me what to do, which people who know me laugh when I'm like, I don't like people telling me what to do. They're like, yeah. I'm like, I didn't realize. Nobody told me. I should have figured that out sooner. I think I just like, you know, when you go into academia, there is a certain level. People don't tell you what to do. Right. Like they tell you, you got to meet these benchmarks, and then they say, go do it. And for some people, that's the downfall, because they don't finish their dissertation or they don't make it through the program. But for me, because I was more of the anxious self-starter person, I didn't need someone to tell me. And my parents didn't used to be like, do your homework. Like that just never was part of my experience, and I didn't need it. So then when I was in a system where they were like, you need to do this, literally one time my boss was like, can you do this? And I was like, no. It's like, no, I will not do that. So, you know, we were getting to, it wasn't going to last too long. So anyway, I just knew another job isn't the solution. Like I just knew that very deeply. And so what started to happen was I started to get some speaking opportunities, and I had one in particular that was with a pretty big company, and it opened my eyes. I could actually make good money and do something that I love, because I basically was like, oh, will you pay me this much? And they were like, we'd love to have you come, and we're going to give you $5,000 more than what you asked for. And I was like, oh. And then I did the event and I felt energized and excited, and it was so, felt so good. Oh, I can make money doing what I love. Yeah. This is actually what I want to do. So it's just opened my eyes. And then I got connected into this online business world where people were like having courses and making money that way. I would prefer to like take my wisdom straight to people to help them. That's how I feel I'm better designed. Mm-hmm. And seeing the possibilities opened me up to like, I think I could do this. And I also knew I could have a private practice and generate income that way. And so it just felt very clear. Another job isn't the solution, right?
Exactly. And do you remember what the talk was about?
So it was with Google, and the talk was about claiming your worth. It was literally on what I talk about, you know, claiming your worth, how unconditional self-worth helps you to feel better as a human and show up better at work. The other speaker was Soledad O'Brien.
What?
Like I spoke and then Soledad O'Brien spoke. And I was like, what? Like, what's happening?
What is happening? That's awesome.
So yeah, it was really cool. It was a very cool experience.
And so do you feel that's the way it really got started, is that you had this experience? I mean, it's so interesting, because when I'm coaching women about career pivots or making shifts, a lot of it is about what lights you up. Mm-hmm. And there's drudgery to every job, but there has to be a spark, and there has to be this feeling of energy in order for it to be something that I think is sustainable over the long term for most people, right? So you had that feeling, because public speaking is not everybody's number one go-to that they
especially
enjoy.
Especially people's like number one fear.
Exactly, exactly. And so what's so interesting, and I mean, you know, when you're an academic, you have a lot of public speaking. You just get speaking experience when you're teaching, you get it. Mm-hmm. So I get that, but I think, and so how did you then develop did you just decide, okay, I'm going to go network and see what other kinds of speaking opportunities I can get? And of course, it helps that you have your first one was at Google, right? Because then you can say,
I actually started speaking before then. Google was like the first big paying one. But I would say I really started speaking when, I mean, I gave a graduation speech, but I also, when I was working at the counseling center, I did a lot of outreach, right? I did outreach workshops and it was one of my favorite things. So I was cultivating this skill set and tapping into this ability and something that I enjoyed for a while. And you're right, teaching was one of the ways that I did that. So there was a lot of little ways. And then I gave a TEDx talk. Actually, it was TEDx DePaul in 2018.
Okay.
And so that was where I taught, the title is Cultivating Unconditional Self-Worth. And so I did that in 2018. And that really has been incredibly generous. I mean, that's how I got the Google gig, because it's like, now it has over a million views, which is still a little like mine. But so that's helped. And I will say one of the things I am very currently still working on is what is my proactive mechanism for getting more speaking opportunities? Because I think a lot of what happens is I've been really lucky to get referrals or get, you know what I mean? Like get people reaching out to me. Yeah. And I do need, because it is a business and running a business, I do need to get better at, okay, what's my proactive way of reaching out, connecting, getting opportunities. That's definitely a growth edge for me, I'll say.
Yeah. And then there's these other pieces of your business, right, that you started considering doing. And I'm curious, because I know you're doing coaching on unconditional self-worth. And I wonder why coaching instead of counseling?
Mm-hmm. That is a good question. So I don't know if I've ever thought through this answer, which is why I'm pausing. The framework of therapy is one, at least what I use, is very open-ended and not super structured. And certainly there are manualized therapies.
Yep.
And that's not what I usually did. And I also think that's not usually what people are coming for.
I see.
And so with my coaching, I started with a course. So I created a course called the Unconditionally Worthy Course. And then even the first time I ran it, I had live Q&A on Zoom. And really, it was kind of like coaching, right?
Yeah.
And so then I was like, this is a coaching program.
Right.
So let's call it what it is. And let's, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And also, I love it, right? Like, I love doing it. But there's more structure. I'm more direct. Hey, try this, etc. It still has elements that are certainly therapeutic. But the framework and the expectation are different. Often when people are coming into therapy, sometimes they want change, sometimes, but sometimes they just want a space to vent and process, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. But what I was finding, and I often found this, is that is not really aligned with how I want to work. And so when I was at the counseling center, it was a short term that worked really well for my style. But when I was in private practice and like we were doing therapy for years and it was just, okay, vent about your day. I couldn't do it anymore. So I actually closed my clinical practice last year before I had a baby, because I was just feeling like I wasn't able to hold the space people needed. And in the group coaching, because it's very clear, like what this is, what you're signing up for, you're signing up to do this work. You're investing money, you're investing time. It's proactive. It's in a group. So it's a different framework that's better aligned with how I want to help people. And also for me, better aligned with how I see people make changes in a short period of time versus years. You know, I had a group coaching member who, you know, she had been in therapy for years and years, probably at least a decade. And she did the program. And then after the program, her therapist was like, what program did you just do? Like, let me send some other people to that program, right? Because it did something that was this intervention that was much more sort of powerful and move things more quickly. And I'm not saying it's magic because it does take work, but it's just a framework that aligns better with how I want to help people.
So it sounds like you did open a clinical psychology practice for a little while as you were in this transition and building the business and doing the speaking and making the course. And then you've shut that down, which is kind of amazing that you're out on your own doing coaching, doing this course, doing the speaking. What's up with the book? Tell me about the book that you got coming up.
So back in, when did we start? I think it was like 2018. A colleague of mine, she works at the Family Institute. We did a training for the Psychology Association on working with Black women mm-hmm. in therapy. And then we started doing a series of trainings. And then we did one for the American Psychological Association annual convention. And it would be really cool to like write a book. And when we did the one for APA, we got approached by a couple of editors. And they were like, hey, are you thinking of writing a book? So anyway, we ended up going with Cambridge University Press. And
fancy.
We have been working on this book. Yeah, fancy. Very fancy. We've been working on this book since, gosh, I think it was we got the book contract end of 2019.
Wow.
And so we were working on it in the pandemic. So it's been a labor of love, certainly, but really a great experience. We've taken a collaborative approach. So it's Donna and I, and then we've also invited other collaborating authors who are like, I invited a friend who's in public health, right? To write a chapter with me on public health, or someone who's an expert in trauma to write a mm-hmm. chapter with me on that. So it's been really a great project. I mean, long, right? Like it's long, it takes a long time, but so exciting to have it release into the world. I think the release date is April 30th. It's also, you can pre-order it now, which is really awesome. Cool. I mean, our hope is really that it will both be a resource for healing and thriving for Black women themselves, and that it will be incredibly helpful for practitioners, clinicians, psychiatrists, therapists, doctors, anybody who works with Black women to understand, to have insights on the experiences of Black women navigating life in America.
Wow, that's incredible. And it's kind of cool too, because there are the pieces of this business that you've created that have all these hallmarks of academic life, right? So you're working on a book, you created a course, you have added the mentoring/coaching, you know what I mean?
Right.
But it's all on your own terms.
It's so funny that you point that out, because I don't think I've thought about it that way before, but you're right. It is a lot of the stuff that I did when I was in academia, but it is on my own terms. And I also work way less. I'm still getting out of the habits of stress and busyness and rush that I learned, some from my own anxiety and all that stuff, but some from being in an academic setting. So I work way less than most academics. I basically work from 10 to 4 on weekdays. That's it.
Yeah.
Right. So I work less and I also make more money and I have the impact I want to have. So it is these elements, but it's on my own terms and it feels really good and it feels aligned. And I don't have to worry about the things. I have to worry about some things I don't like operations and SOPs, which, you know, I don't care about, but I know I need them. But I don't have to worry about pulling together all my research and, oh, did I do enough? And will I be at like that whole stress? Like, no, thank you for me.
Yeah.
And I am very glad that I don't have to worry about it.
I have so many questions. What do you feel like your journey with unconditional worth has been during this entire evolution of your career as it's unfolded, the decisions that you've made? Give me a little bit of behind the scenes about why this is so important to you and how you've used it in your own life.
Yeah. So, you know, starting as a kid, I felt like something was wrong with me. Mm. I just felt like something's wrong with me. I'd be left out. I wasn't bullied, thankfully, but I just felt like there was something wrong with me. And so I was like, okay, well, just be perfect, right? Like, just be the perfect friend. Just be totally selfish. Okay, be the perfect student. Okay, right? So I went off trying to do all these things. And I took that to the ultimate with getting my PhD. And I often tell the story that I walked out of my dissertation defense having been told that I passed, and I started sobbing. Oh. Because I knew immediately it didn't work. Like, it didn't give me that feeling of worthiness that I had been searching for and working for so long. Yeah. And so it was like, okay, all this stuff, all this external stuff isn't gonna work.
Yeah.
Took me a few more years to realize that the relationships weren't gonna do it either. I went down that road for a while too. Yeah. But it was just like, okay, we gotta turn inward. And so I was learning about meditation. I was learning about how to help people through therapy and started, you know, I was in my own therapy, listened to tons of spiritual teachings and started to pull together that I had to connect to something within me, mm-hmm. that it wasn't gonna be external. So that was my own journey that I was working through. And then when I was in the counseling center at the University of Chicago, a big piece was like these super smart, super high achieving students who were really struggling to feel worthy, who were anxious, who were stressed, who were depressed, who had suicidal ideation, right? And that helped it to click for me that, oh, it's not just me.
Yeah.
Right. Because I hadn't really talked to people about, I knew I was searching for something. I don't even know if I could have articulated that I was like, oh, my self-worth is off. Cause that wasn't really a conversation that was being had.
Yeah.
But it was like, oh, I actually am not the only one who struggles with this. All these students are struggling with it. And so both my own experience as well as seeing people struggle with it helped me to clarify, this is a thing. This is the thing that I needed help with. This is the thing that people need help with. And also experiencing my life, knowing that I'm worthy, just shifted things, right? Like it helped me to stop overworking. It helped me to stop trying to prove that I was worthy. It allowed me to meet my husband and like be in a healthy relationship, right? It allowed me to experience the life that I wanted that I had for so many years struggled with. And I think it's been essential on my journey of entrepreneurship and taking a big leap, right? Because, you know, there's a lot of ways in which being affiliated with an impressive academic institution makes you feel more worthy and also makes other people more impressed with you.
Yep.
Because you're like, oh, well, I work at Northwestern, or, oh, well, I work at blah, blah, blah. And people are like, ooh, you must be smart, right? And if it's like, I work for myself, it's like, oh, well, who knows what you're doing? So knowing and owning my worth, it was part of what helped me say, I'm going to leave academia. Yep. And I'm going to leave all of my affiliations behind and bet on myself and go out and do what I want to do. And the work that I had done on myself and like creating more time for rest, stopping overworking. And I still am, you know, working on those things, but allowed me to move into this space of entrepreneurship without taking all of the toxic things that I picked up in academia with me. I took some of them and then I was like, oh, wait, let me leave that behind. I don't want that. Right. But knowing that I'm worthy means that like every day in my business is it make or break about, can I do it? Am I worthy? Right. Because that certainly you can create that in your business. And I think a lot of people do.
Yeah. How has it been having a baby while running a business?
It has been interesting. There's two main things. So one is just that time feels very different, right? Mm-hmm. The time available to me, the time available to work in some ways, which it can be helpful because there's sort of these boundaries.
Yeah, absolutely.
But my time in the morning, right? Like there's all these things, downtime feels different, right? Like the weekends, like there's no such thing as sleeping in.
No.
Right? Like the baby gets up at 6:30. So that's it.
Yes, there's a definite before and after when you have that first.
Going into it, I knew that my capacity was going to be lower. And part of the reason I closed my clinical practice is because it no longer felt aligned. And part of it was because I was like, my capacity is going to be lower. So I'm not going to be able to do all of these things. And so I'm grateful that I didn't expect myself to work at the same capacity I was working before after having a baby. The other piece for me is that my daughter has some health issues, right? And the health issues mean that sometimes we have to go to the hospital unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. And it's incredibly disruptive. And it's also scary.
Yeah.
She has been fine, thankfully. And, you know, if we have to go to the hospital, and the way it works for her, it's like, often if we're going to the hospital, we're going to be there for 2 days. So that means it's okay. Is my husband calling off? Am I calling off? Are we both calling off? Am I canceling something? Am I right? So there's all of this stuff that ends up being, well, I had the whole week planned and that's out the window. Right. Exactly. And so it has like really forced me into like flexibility, right? And rolling with things, because that is not necessarily my normal tendency, right? Like I like a plan. Yeah. I like to stick with the plan, right? And some of it is babies in general, let that go, right? Yeah. You gotta learn to. But I think there's this extra layer of, is she okay? Do we have to go to the hospital? Is that gonna disrupt things for a couple of days? Am I gonna have to cancel meetings and cancel things I planned, which certainly has happened. Yeah. So that's challenging. And I think the benefit I have is that I'm in the business of helping people show up to life's challenges with grace and compassion. And so it's like, okay, well, got to give myself some grace and compassion and share honestly and not beat myself up. And like, if somebody is like, I don't want to work with you because blah, 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 well, you know, it's probably not a great fit anyway.
Yeah.
Right. And thankfully it hasn't like gotten in the way of speaking engagements or things like that. Thankfully that would be really hard, but it has. I've been putting on events for my business and had to be like, hey, got to pause this. But people are gracious and understanding. And so, you know, it's always worked out okay in the end.
Well, I remember going back to work after I had my oldest, and it was both like I had more time when I was at work, like I could control my time at work, but everything else was about the baby. You know what I mean? And it totally changed my perspective. It made me more productive in regular business hours when I could have childcare and really figure out how to do that instead of staying at the office till 8 p.m. or whatever. It forces you to figure out how to make that work. And, you know, I think it's one of those, somebody right before we had my eldest said, it's just better if you don't know. Like was starting to talk to us about what it's like to have kids. And it's like, you don't need to know.
It's just going blind. Blissful
enjoy
ignorance.
Just be excited. The next 2 months. Yeah. And like, what's hilarious is we were like, we don't get it. And then we did. I just have a couple other final questions. One is, if you could give your 22-year-old self any piece of advice from this vantage point, what would it be?
The first thing that comes to mind is like, slow down and breathe.
Wow.
I'm like, you're okay.
Yeah.
I just didn't feel okay, you know, and I was rushing and I was all this stuff. And it's like, just slow down, breathe one step at a time. You're fine. You're worthy. That would be the wisdom I'd share.
Yeah. And the other question that I usually ask is, how do you think being female, and in your case, Black and female, has affected your career trajectory or decisions that you've made? You know, it's a little bit different because you're an entrepreneur, but I often talk to women who have certain roadblocks, certain different experiences.
That's a good question. I'm not sure I can identify roadblocks. I think in part because I'm in a female dominated field in terms of psychology. I mean, it's certainly like the founders are like white men, but currently most psychologists are women. And I feel like my department was pretty, it didn't feel racist, right? Like it didn't feel like there was a lot of like discrimination or things happening. That doesn't mean that it wasn't. Interestingly, even though I've like done some DEI work, I'm not always the most sensitive to these things happening to me. And I think it's helpful because I'm just kind of like, well, whatever. And I'm also kind of like, well, their problem, not mine. So there's not like a lot of barriers that I can identify. I do know that it would have been much more challenging to have a baby if I was still at my last job, right? Because yeah. I think that often that's like, that can be a big thing for women is like having a baby, right? And like, are you passed over for promotion? Are you acknowledged? Is it seen as a birth, right? Like all of those things. And so even though I wasn't making money during my maternity leave, I'd saved up some to pay for myself. It's nice to have a paid maternity leave versus like a unpaid maternity leave. It was helpful to know that like I wasn't messing up my career, right? Like there wasn't this fear that like my career is going to be really interrupted or challenged, right? Like if you're going up for tenure and then you have a year or two where you, right? Like that's a real challenge. And so I think I exited before some of those things would have been kind of more at play and affected me.
Yeah. Yeah. I waited to go up for tenure. I got pregnant the fall, I think, that I went up for tenure. Because I was just like, I don't think I'm going to be able to do what I need to do. And which I think is kind of horrid because, you know, you have, you get your PhD, you're in your 30s, you're already coming up against the clock. And then I'm like, saying no, I need to wait a few more
five more years, yeah,
make sure that I have enough research to go up for promotion and tenure, which is a terrible idea.
And it's like if you work at one of these tech companies, they're probably it's not a guarantee, but they're probably at least paying to freeze your eggs, but that's not happening.
No, not in academia. And it's also like the case too, especially in academia, the way you get hired, you move away from family often or friends because you're on a national job market. And so it's also the case that you typically don't have family in the area. So it sounds being an entrepreneur, you're able to create your own schedule and do your own thing and really make the life and your schedule the way you want it.
Yeah. Like I hate 9 a.m. meetings. And so I like to jokingly say like, unless Oprah calls, I'm probably not going to meet at 9 a.m. I mean, maybe if it's like a big, but like, I don't like, you know what I mean? I get rushed. I like a slow morning. I like to do my thing and eat breakfast and meditate and blah, blah, blah. And so you're going to see that my availability is like 11 to 4. 4 p.m. because that's when my nanny leaves. And I don't really want to do stuff before 11 because then I'm rushed. And like, guess what? I control that. It's really nice. And I can make exceptions, but like, that's my schedule. And that's, it's really, you know, it works for me. And it's actually how I then show up best to do the work that I need to do.
I mean, it's all full circle, right? Nobody's telling you when to be, where, what to be. It's all consistent. Thank you so much for this interview. It was so great to hear more of your story and to hear about the origin story of your awesome business. If people want to get to know you a little bit better.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been fun. So people can go to my website, dradiagooden.com. I'm also on Instagram and LinkedIn. So Dr. Adia Gooden on LinkedIn and at Dr. Adia Gooden on Instagram. And then if people are curious about like self-worth, that sort of thing, I have a free ebook call that people can get. That's about 4 practices to start connecting to your unconditional self-worth. And you can get that at my website, dradiagooden.com/free-ebook.
Great. Awesome. Well, I will make sure all of those links are in the show notes. It's been great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been fun. Thanks, Julie.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Her Leading Story. If you love this episode, please help me reach more women by leaving a review wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for being here, and I'll see you next week.